Capital Market Insights from ICMA.
Welcome to this ICMA podcast. My name is Leland Goss. I'm a member of the Executive Committee, and I'm delighted to have with us here today Mark Chandler, who's a Managing Director at Bannockburn Global Forex. Mark, you specialize in foreign exchange and suggested that looking at the world through the foreign exchange market is like looking through a picture glass window. Can you unbundle that for us?
Yeah, sure. So I spent my whole career in foreign exchange. It's this $6.6 trillion a day turnover market, and it's the biggest of the capital markets. And what this means really, $6.6 trillion is just a mind-boggling number. That means that in 1 week, the foreign exchange market sees enough flows to cover world trade for a year. And so all those things that affect stocks and bonds, affects interest rates, also affect the foreign exchange market, plus more. So I think that the foreign exchange market, whether it's portfolio flows, direct investment flows, interbank dealings, I think the foreign exchange market offers us insight into what these other markets are doing in a way that what's happening in stocks or what might be happening in bonds might not affect foreign exchange. I think the foreign exchange market also brings us a broader perspective, keeps us global in nature, and that's where I think that it's the most exciting part of the economy, really, is that the part that interfaces globally.
Mark, can you share your expectation for the year ahead?
What the foreign exchange market, I think, is telling us is that it's going to be a tough first couple of months of 2021, but I think the market is really anticipating reflation. That is, major central banks, governments have taken quick action, decisive action, large action that is going to lead to a stronger recovery once we get the virus under control. And the market is thinking that the virus is under control late Q2, early Q3. And so what this means then is that in the reflation trade, it means that the focus then shifts from, you know, the U.S. dollar has been strong for several years now, and by many measures, it's still overvalued. And I think that the framing of what's going to happen in 2021. When I listen to our clients, when I read what other analysts are saying, when I participate in roundtables, it seems that even if they're not calling it as much, the arguments fit into a refocus on the twin deficits. That is, the U.S., like most countries, have a budget deficit. But unlike our major trading partners like Europe, like Japan, like China, the U.S. has a broad trade deficit, a current account deficit, and these twin deficits typically require higher interest rates or wider growth differentials to attract funds into the U.S. And for various reasons, of course, that can't happen right now, given the virus and given the state of the U.S. economy and the world economy, that the dollar sort of acts as a shock absorber. And so I think the dollar declines this year as part of the overall reflation trade.
Mark, COVID has resulted in significant monetary expansion, particularly in the U.S. Do you see the return, finally, of wage price inflation and adverse consequences this is likely to have for bondholders?
A very good point, because I think that inflation is really foremost on many investors' minds. And partly, you know, with interest rates so low, $15 trillion of negative yielding bonds in Europe and Asia, a small tick up in inflation could really impact investors. I think there's three elements to the inflation story, but I don't look for the wage push inflation to emerge. The first part of the inflation story is really mathematical. It's that last year, last March and April, inflation was negative. CPI fell. And when we look at the year-over-year comparisons, those are going to drop out of the measures this year. And even if they're replaced by a zero, headline inflation, as we measured, CPI is going to rise as those negative prints get dropped out. That's sort of baked in the cake. That's, I think, going to cause a bit of an inflation scare this spring. But the good news is that last summer, the CPI bounced strongly, and those will get dropped out of the index. And so the inflation fare this spring will ease again in the summer. But the second part of the inflation story, I think this is the one that your question really points to, and that is many economists think that the kindling wood for inflation has been laid, whether it's the rapid growth of monetary aggregates, whether it is the low interest rates, whether it is central banks like the Federal Reserve saying they're willing to tolerate higher inflation, changing the target from 2% inflation to an average of 2%. People, I think, are also looking at fiscal policy. I think that they see a lot of the income that was lost has been replaced, and for some people, even more. At the same time, a lot of the service sector, small businesses, you think about the barbershop, seamstress, the nail salon, a lot of the restaurants, these have closed, and people are, I think, are afraid that when COVID, when we overcome the pandemic, there's going to be a surge of demand just at the same time we've lost capacity. And so that's another source of inflation, is the kindling wood for it has been laid and whether or not there's going to be a spark. The third source of inflation worries seem to be coming from structural arguments. Some of it's demographic. I mean, here's really the story of in our career, say going back to 1980, inflation and interest rates have been generally trending lower. And some people think that that secular trend could be over, not because of COVID per se, but because the changes that are taking place in society during COVID and around COVID. For example, globalization is really about the spreading of production around the world to low-cost places. And if globalization is going to be unwound in part or in whole, then the cost savings from globalization will also unwind. Some people think that the decline in interest rates and inflation was partly of this demographic function. You think about what happened previously, and that is China became integrated in the world economy. The Soviet Union collapsed. All those workers in China and the former Soviet Union became integrated in the world economy. And that basically had the shift then between the power, relative power between capital and labor in favor of capital, a lot more labor involved. And so if this also, if that process of integrating China and this old Soviet Union back into the world economy, if that process is complete or nearly so, maybe the deflationary impulse also gets unwound. My best guess right now, though, is that we get this inflation scare, but this 40-year downtrend in inflation is significant, and it's not going to go away, I think, anytime soon, even if we get this bounce in inflation. We know what a lot of us buy, and when I say us, I mean in high-income countries, we buy services more than goods. And yet the goods inflation is still really deflationary. So when we look at the measures of inflation, we're combining goods and services. In the U.S., the key measure, the key elements of our basket of inflation that we measure is two components really that account for half, shelter and medical services. And you can imagine during COVID, the price of shelter has fallen. Rents, for example, in New York are about 25% lower. We've got to imagine that housing prices, as well as commercial real estate, has fallen in price. On the other side, medical costs seem relatively high. That's been a source of inflation. But one of the things that the COVID has brought about, even like having a podcast like this, more things are being done on the internet. And we're finding that there's some medical services that can actually be conducted online. And so I suspect that technology is going to keep service prices generally low, even if we do get this inflation scare after the economies open back up.
There's still a steady stream in the traditional and social media that sees the U.S. in decline and dollar set to lose its place in the global economy. Talk of possible other currencies becoming the world's reserve currency. Where do you stand?
Yeah, you know, I think in my career, this is a repeated issue that keeps circulating. I think that people have generally been anticipating a demise of the dollar for most of my career. And I don't think that it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen anytime soon. Partly, I point out that central banks don't just keep their reserves in dollars and cash in those kind of notes that we have in our pocket. What they do is they deposit them into treasuries. And so I'd say the key behind the dollar as a reserve asset is the role of the treasury market, which is the deepest, broadest, most liquid market, which means that, for example, Russia a few years ago, because they were being penalized and the U.S. had weaponized access to the dollar, they seem to have shifted their reserves out of dollars. But it comes at a price, especially for a country of modest reserves like Russia with, say, about $500 billion. One thing that happens is they're going to give up yield. So if they, for example, buy German Bunds, a safe European bond, they're looking at a negative yield compared to, say, 1% yield of U.S. treasuries. So first, in order to avoid the U.S. dollar and avoid treasuries, diversify away from the dollar, you give up yield. You give up size of the market. That's liquidity. The German Bund market is a fraction of the size of the U.S. Treasury market. And the U.S. Treasury market trades almost 24 hours a day. The Bund is still primarily a European bond market. And so in addition to the yield you give up, the liquidity you give up, I think that also, think about the size. When the U.S. has an auction, they're selling, say, $30, $40, $50 billion of an instrument. And if you're a large pool of capital, like a sovereign wealth fund or a central bank, the size of the European bond auctions tend to be much smaller. In fact, I sort of wonder if the European bond market is more like the U.S. muni market, where you have a bunch of different issuers, a bunch of different rules regarding how they issued and how they marketed, how they traded. And so I think that the euro can't really replace the dollar until it has a single deep bond market, which doesn't seem likely anytime soon. And the other alternative people say is about China. I think it's just a misuse of numbers. Sometimes they get to watch these mixed martial art fighters or boxers, and they talk about sometimes a small guy who might be, they say, pound for pound stronger than one of the big guys. But it doesn't mean that the small guy can actually beat up the big guy. It just means that the small guy was that size, he could. And so China is still a relatively poor country. Think about GDP per capita. And it's smaller than the U.S. But of course, when you pound for pound, given that the population is like four times larger than the United States, you'd expect that pound for pound, China is bigger. But that's really a misuse of it. And the Chinese currency is not really convertible. Many of our clients on the corporate side, they will trade the Chinese RMB in Hong Kong. We call it CNH. Or they might trade the non-deliverable forward because access to the onshore market is more difficult. I think that there are a lot of problems the dollar has. The U.S. is the world's largest debtor. But I think that in the near to medium term, 5, 10, 15, 20 years, the dollar's role seems fairly secure to me, not just because of the U.S. is the large economy, dynamic economy, but because of inertia and the lack of compelling alternatives. You know, we both use the same keyboard, QWERTY, you know, and there's better keyboards, more ergonomically designed, take up less time to press the keys, but we're very unlikely to adopt that. And this is partly the first mover advantage, and also speaks to the idea that for an alternative, compelling alternative, it can't just be as good as, but it's got to be better than, to make that change. And I just don't see anything on the horizon to suggest that exists.
You were one of the few analysts who argued that Greece was not going to leave monetary union a decade ago. The doubts over the ability to have a monetary union without a fiscal union remain. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think that in the U.S. we sort of pride ourselves thinking that we were the great experiment. Could you have a representative form of government over a large territory? And the classic political philosopher said you couldn't do it. And here, 250 odd years later, the U.S. has shown we could do it. And I think that in some ways, Europe is the great experiment of our generation. Can you have monetary union without fiscal union? I think that Europe, like the U.S., is a work in progress. And so I think that a very interesting development at the end of last year where the EU approved the recovery fund, they will issue joint bonds. And so I think that the founders of Europe, of modern Europe, thought that it could only grow in crisis. Crisis sort of forces people to sacrifice some sovereignty or what apparent sovereignty for a more shared sovereignty. And I think this is the direction Europe is going, though it's a painfully slow. But I think that many criticisms of Europe say that it's not an optimal currency zone. That what happens in the Mediterranean countries does not necessarily affect Northern Europe or vice versa. And that's true. And I'd say the U.S. is not an optimal currency zone either when it was force founded. But I think that for me, the key is that Europe's coming together is not about economics, but the driver is really about politics. You know, Henry Kissinger, the former U.S. Secretary of State, once said that you have to pity Germany, too big for Europe and too small for the world. And I think that my understanding would be that the way to avoid these needless continental wars is to have Europe greater integration. And that's one thing that people might talk about, how fast Italy's grown since the advent of the euro, or what's happened to inflation or this or that. But we've been at peace in our lifetime. And I think partly it's because of integration. And I think that's the way it's perceived. So for me, the Eurozone monetary union is really an economic solution to a fundamental political problem. And that political problem, monetary union, if not accidental, the monetary union comes about shortly after the unification of Germany. So I think it's like partly the Lilliputians tying down Gulliver into a network of relationships so that, you know, even at the towards the end of the Cold War, Germany seemed to outgrow parts of Europe. It began pursuing Ostpolitik, sort of a east-looking foreign policy. And so I think that monetary union and these network of web of relationships is all to have a stronger Europe and to keep Germany anchored, Germany's future anchored into Europe.
Christine Lagarde, the European Central Bank president, has said it's not their job to manage euro area government bond spreads. Is this the only means, however, to manage the problem that weak euro area economies cannot devalue their currency at the national level?
And you raise a good point. So the issue in some ways, if the currencies are fixed for all practical purposes, that's what it means, they have this common currency, then how can the adjustment be made? If to stay competitive in the past, Italy or Spain or even France would devalue against the Deutschmark and preserve their competitiveness. However, with monetary union, that path is blocked from them. And so the interest rate market has sort of borne some of that adjustment process. But I think there's another way in which I think we're seeing this now. And this is what happened in Greece as well. One way to restore that competitiveness is have your country, Italy in this case, or Greece, lower inflation than Germany. And that also then leads to an adjustment, though it's a painful adjustment because the deflationary adjustment happens at lower economic activity, lower prices, as opposed to sort of the Anglo-American way of inflating our way out of problems sometimes. So I do think that interest rate differentials are a key factor, but here's what I think happens is when the ECB puts their money on the line and they sort of act as a backstop saying we will buy Italian bonds, we're going to be buying Spanish bonds, and our pandemic emergency purchase program allows us to be more flexible than the capital key. That what this does is this induces other pools of capital to buy European bonds. So for example, we've seen Japanese institutions be large buyers of Italian bonds, partly because they know they've got the ECB at their back, and partly it's this quest for higher yields. Once we assume, I grant you it's a big assumption, but once we assume that everybody who's in monetary union stay in monetary union, that is to say that there's not going to be a re-denomination risk, then the credit risk gets reduced dramatically. I think that the reason why investors demand a premium for Italian bonds or Spanish bonds or Portuguese bonds is that small chance that they could leave the system. And once that can be fully eradicated, no one really thinks that Texas is going to leave the United States or Florida is going to leave the United States or Ohio. Once we can have that same confidence in Europe, I think you'll see the spreads narrow on their own.
Leaving aside macroeconomics and geopolitics, let's talk about the capital markets themselves. You began your career on the floor of the CME shortly before they stopped putting bids and offers on a chalkboard. We've come a long way. What's next?
It's been a great story of our life is what's happened to the financial sector. A couple of things that strike me. One is just like the financial sector has helped finance incredible innovations in other sectors, rationalizing other sectors, the same thing is happening to the capital markets, where technology is increasingly replacing employees. We're like de-skilling workers and giving these to machines, whether it is algos, artificial intelligence, even on the analytics side, being able to do a word count. How many times in the Fed speeches did they mention the word inflation? Things like that that us puny humans find difficult. I think that so the capital markets become more capital intensive, and as they become more capital intensive, less labor intensive, I think it's a bit of an arms race. Who's got the faster computers? Who's got the faster algorithm of the next generation? But it's about capital, and I think that because it's about capital and not about smart or witty analysts or economists, more about faster machines, I think it leads to a greater concentration consolidation, which itself poses other risks. I think that the skills that we demand from our employees are different too. I saw this job at a very large money center bank for a spot trader. And I thought that spot traders, for the most part on the job, have a two-word vocabulary. Mine, meaning they bought it, and yours, meaning they sold it. But this job requirement asked that traders had working knowledge of three computer languages. So I think that tells you the sort of direction as far as the technical skills. But I also think from the soft skills. You know, it used to be if somebody was smart and good, that was good enough for them to get a job. But now it seems that there's more emphasis, because the work processes have changed, more emphasis on the kind of teamwork skills. So it's not that anybody's skills are good or bad in and of themselves, but how they fit into the team. I also think that a big change has taken place partly through COVID, but it was beginning before COVID in the foreign exchange market, but now clearly has spread to other markets, including, but especially equities. And that is a rise of retail investors. And we see this in the futures market with these mini contracts that are about half the size, sometimes even smaller than the regular size contracts. And that's just bringing in a new part, a new constituents, if you will, new investors moving to the futures with these smaller contracts. And so there I'd put the Japanese might have been ahead of Europe and the U.S., but the rise of retail investors in a number of different markets, including equities and currencies. I also think about the shift that's taking place with, given what's Brexit, given the changes in Hong Kong, where financial centers seem a bit more fluid, partly because technology has increased what we call the C3, the span of control communication has spread. We don't need to have these fixed financial centers where the employees are close to the markets. Instead, I think what we're seeing is many banks looking for alternatives to London as a center, whether it's Ireland, whether it's the continent. You know, the continent, especially Paris, has always wanted to be a big financial center. And maybe there's more of an attempt now to have something on the continent and for euro clearing. And in Asia, of course, Hong Kong is a major hub. Of course, for China, Shanghai competes. But I talk to many businesses that are re-looking at Singapore, looking at Tokyo again. And so I think we see more fluidity in these financial centers, partly as a result of the geopolitics and partly as a result of technology.
This brings us to the end of our discussion. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. For more ICMA podcasts and further information on capital markets, please visit our website, icmagroup.org.